William Morrow and Harper Audio present A Sacred Oath, Memoirs of a Secretary of Defense During Extraordinary Times by Mark T. Esper. Read by Joe Knezovich. To my wife and best friend Leah, and our children Luke, Jack, and Kate. And to the West Point class of 1986, with whom I swore my first oath to the Constitution on July 1, 1982, and for whom courage never quits. And to the men and women of the U.S. Department of Defense, who honor their sacred oaths each and every day, and in whom our great nation's safety, security, and future is entrusted. I, Mark Esper, do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I take this obligation freely, without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I am about to enter. So help me God. Mark T. Esper, Oath of Office as Secretary of Defense, The White House, Washington, D.C., July 23, 2019. A note before we begin. For appendices and notes from the print edition, be sure to download the accompanying enhancement PDF from your audiobook provider or go directly to www.harpercollins.com/pages/A Sacred Oath. For more detailed information on the life and career of Mark T. Esper, please visit his website at www.marktesper.com. Introduction. A meeting like no other. "Can't you just shoot them? Just shoot them in the legs or something?" he asked. I couldn't believe the President of the United States just suggested the U.S. military shoot our fellow Americans in the streets of the nation's capital. The moment was surreal. Sitting in front of the Resolute desk, inside the Oval Office, with this idea weighing heavily in the air, and the President red-faced and complaining loudly about the protests underway in Washington, D.C. When I accepted the job as Secretary of Defense the previous year, I knew I would face tough issues. Questions of war and peace, for example. But never anything like this. The good news? This wasn't a difficult decision. The bad news? I had to figure out a way to walk Trump back without creating the mess I was trying to avoid. This wasn't how I ever thought the first week of June 2020, or any week for that matter, would begin. Monday, June 1st, 2020 started like most others. I arrived early at the Pentagon after hitting the gym, did a quick review of the day's intelligence, and then picked through my read-ahead book for the tab on my 8 a.m. meeting, the Secretary's Weekly Policy Review, or SWIPR, as we called it. This meeting included the civilian and military leadership of the Department of Defense, DOD, from the Office of the Secretary of Defense, OSD, and Joint Staff to the Service Secretaries and their uniformed chiefs, the four-star heads of the Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, and Space Force. Before the pandemic, we gathered in the large Nunn-Lugar conference room opposite my office on the E-ring of the Pentagon and sat around the big wooden table, the Deputy Secretary of Defense to my right and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to my left, by rank, with aides and assistants lining the walls. The table could fit nearly 24 people. In the era of COVID, however, we now met by secure video from our desks. I initiated the SWIPR my first week in office. It would be that one meeting where we combined the important work of going through our organizational priorities as a joint team of civilian and military leaders with the more immediate matters of pending issues and current events. It would also help me close the civilian-military divide that had opened over time. About halfway through the June 1st SWIPR meeting, my secure phone rang a few times and then stopped. One of my assistants in the front office must have picked it up, I thought. Moments later, I saw General Mark Milley drop off the screen, which was unusual for the Joint Chiefs Chairman. My phone soon rang again, and I discovered exactly why he had vanished so abruptly. Milley was spun up. He had urgent news. General Mark Milley is a barrel-chested soldier with dark, bushy eyebrows who hails from the Boston area. A standout hockey player in school, he graduated from Princeton in 1980 and was commissioned as an armor officer. After 40 years of army service, he had multiple combat tours and a lifetime of experience under his belt. He carried a stern look on his face that belied a quick sense of humor, and he could fill a room with his booming voice, which often spoke in exclamation points and language not always made to be taken literally. The president, ever drawn to appearances, would often say he was straight out of central casting. I turned the meeting over to my deputy and took the chairman's call. Milley was unusually animated now, and rightfully so. Minutes earlier, the president had called him, he said, in a fury over what happened in the streets of D.C. the prior evening, when more than 1,000 people gathered to protest the killing of George Floyd, as was happening around the country. Protesters marched through the streets and gathered in Lafayette Park, right across from the White House. Fires were lit, windows were smashed, and people were hurt as some in the crowd grew violent. The chaotic scenes played over and over on television, and undoubtedly caught Trump's attention. The president thought his administration looked weak and wanted something done. I asked General Milley to come up to my office. The fact that Trump called him was unusual, and Milley's quick summary was very troubling. I was anxious to sit with him and tease the conversation out, to understand exactly what the president said. The general arrived quickly. His demeanor was very serious. His face, ashen. I wondered how many times in his years in the military he had ever looked this way. "The president is really angry," Milley said. "He thinks it's a disgrace what happened last night. He wants 10,000 troops deployed to stop the violence. I told him I had to speak with you."
10,000 troops, really? He said that?" I asked.
"Yes, sir," he responded with a serious but slightly wide-eyed look.
10,000.
I shook my head in disbelief. I knew some of the protesters had become violent and damage had occurred, including to the historic Episcopal Church directly across from the White House. Vandalism is never acceptable, but the perpetrators were a small minority in a much larger crowd. Law enforcement, as well as some D.C. National Guardsmen who were on duty to support them, suffered injuries. Otherwise, they had things under control. I'd received updates throughout the weekend, but there were no urgent calls for additional troops. "Where did the number 10,000 come from?" I asked Milley. He didn't know. In any event, Milley and I both understood that deploying active duty forces into the nation's capital was a terrible idea, and if anything, it would likely incite more violence. We also knew it was impossible to send this many in 12 hours. It took the most elite units in the U.S. military a few hours to deploy, and they were our most ready forces. Minutes later, a member of my staff came in to inform us the president called a snap meeting for 10:30 a.m. to discuss the protests. Milley and I were already scheduled to be at the White House at 11 a.m. for a call with the nation's governors regarding the ongoing civil unrest. We looked at each other and grimaced, silently acknowledging that we were in for another interesting morning. Milley and I trudged over to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue that morning for what turned out to be a very heated encounter with the president. It was loud, contentious, and unreal. We did manage to avoid a terrible outcome, the one that Trump wanted, but we were shaken, and it wasn't even noon yet. As we briskly left the meeting and crossed the threshold into the outer office where the president's schedulers sat, Milley put his thumb and forefinger tightly together, close to his face, leaned in, and whispered to me that he was this close to resigning on the spot. So was I. What transpired that day would leave me deeply troubled about the leader of our country and the decisions he was making. I was worried for our democracy. At that point, having served as Donald Trump's Secretary of Defense for about a year, I had seen many red flags, many warnings, and many inconsistencies. But now we seemed on the verge of crossing a dark red line. We had walked up to these thresholds in the past, but never one this important, and never with such rage.
At times like this, I asked myself why I didn't resign. This was the existential question of the Trump administration. Why did good people stay even after the president suggested or pressed us to do things that were reckless or foolish or just plain wrong? Why did we remain even after he made outrageous or false statements or denigrated our people, our departments, or us? I wrestled with these questions many times during my tenure, and especially in the months following the events of June 1st. It demanded a lot of soul-searching, reaching back into my upbringing, my education at West Point, and my training in the Army, studying historical examples, speaking with my predecessors in both parties, thinking hard about my oath, and talking it through with my wife. On more than one occasion, Leah would say to me, "As your wife, please quit. As an American citizen, please stay." Quitting in outrage would have made me feel good in the moment. It would have saved me a ton of stress and criticism. News outlets and social media would likely hail me as a resistance hero. However, I didn't think it was the right thing to do for our country. And as I told a reporter once near the end of my tenure, "My soldiers don't get to quit when the going gets tough, so I won't either." I agonized nonetheless. Many of us did. There was another major concern I had to factor into the equation. Who would replace me? There likely wasn't enough time for the president to nominate and the Senate to confirm a new defense secretary. Nevertheless, Trump could certainly place a true loyalist as acting secretary. And given enough time, real damage could be done. We saw this earlier in the year when he installed Rick Grenell as the acting director of national intelligence. There were a number of people in the administration who would willingly do Trump's bidding, and probably even his more extreme dictates, and it deeply concerned me. As readers of this book will learn, the president or some of his top White House aides proposed to take some type of military action in or against other nations on multiple occasions during the nearly 18 months I served as Secretary of Defense. Other recommendations were so careless that they easily could have provoked a conflict. Some of these proposed actions are still unknown to the public. Some could even have led to war. On each of those occasions, sober minds pulled us back from the brink. What would happen, I wondered, if we were all gone? Some of the decisions made by the Pentagon leadership after I left, other actions attempted but not consummated, and even further, matters reportedly discussed at the White House in mid-December to use the military to enable a recount, would later validate my concerns. And of course, nothing was more troubling than the horrific, Trump-inspired assault on the Capitol on January 6, 2021. I stayed because I didn't want our military politicized, let alone shooting civilians or collecting ballot boxes. I also didn't want to start any unnecessary wars, break any alliances, or compromise our nation's security. I stayed because I thought it was the right thing to do, and because I knew we would do our best to do the right thing as long as I was Secretary of Defense. I say that reluctantly, knowing it may come across as vainglorious, but it was how I felt and what I believed. We had a sacred oath to the Constitution, after all, not to the president or a party. It was about the country and our values. In the end, the answer always came back to staying and fighting the good fight, the necessary one. To get some important things accomplished for the country and the military in the time I had, which we did, but also to stop bad things from happening, which we also did on a number of occasions. I was never concerned about being fired, only about being fired too soon. This was the high wire I had to walk until Election Day, in order to do so and keep the Defense Department out of politics and the military out of elections, however, I would need a new game plan after June 1st, 2020. Donald Trump would not make that easy. This book aims to tell that story. The story of my decisions and perspectives during one of the most chaotic, difficult, and consequential periods in modern American history. An extraordinary period where we fought a global pandemic the likes of which the world hadn't seen in a century. Dealt with the greatest domestic unrest in two generations. Battled aggressive actions by hostile powers and terrorist groups around the world. Confronted novel challenges from peer, near-peer rivals in a new era of great power competition. began transforming the U.S. military through implementation of a new national defense strategy, and endeavored to do all of this while dealing with an idiosyncratic, unpredictable, and unprincipled commander-in-chief. Army Doctrinal Publication 2.0, Intelligence, published in July 2019, describes a peer threat, or rival in this context, as an adversary or enemy with capabilities and capacity to oppose U.S. forces across multiple domains worldwide or in a specific region where they enjoy a position of relative advantage. Peer threats possess roughly equal combat power in geographical proximity to a conflict area with U.S. forces. At the beginning of this century, China and Russia were considered by a majority of national security experts to be near peers, who lacked certain capabilities or capacity that could challenge the U.S. military in a material way. Recent modernization efforts by both countries, especially China, has prompted many of these same experts to begin describing one or both of these countries as peer threats to the United States. This was not a position I ever expected to be in when I was a young boy growing up in a small coal mining town 46 miles southeast of Pittsburgh. My birthplace, Uniontown, was founded on July 4, 1776, not far from Fort Necessity, a small circular stockade built by George Washington during the French and Indian War. General George C. Marshall, the area's favorite son, was born and raised in Uniontown. His home, which later became the site of the local VFW, was no more than a quarter mile from where I first lived. Marshall and I used to play in the same creek that ran between our homes, I'd muse, though with about 90 years of time between our boyhood exploits. In the 1960s, Uniontown was about 17,000 strong, and its diversity was marked by the various places of worship dotting the city, each identified by the ethnic groups that attended them and the foods, customs, language, and histories their congregants brought to our tight-knit community. People from this blue-collar area were generally conservative, patriotic, and hard-working. We were considered Reagan Democrats in the 1980s. By that time, unfortunately, the collapse of the steel industry, which had begun in the previous decade, had hit the region hard. Many coal mines went under too, taking thousands of jobs with them. This was a historic change from which most small towns in southwest Pennsylvania would never recover. My late father, Tom, was a welfare caseworker for the state. His family had emigrated from Lebanon at the turn of the century. He had seven brothers and sisters, all of whom spoke Arabic and continued some of the traditions of their homeland. My mother, Polly, was a homemaker who traced her roots back to County Cork in Ireland. Her maiden name was Reagan, and she claimed to be part of the Reagan clan that came to the States in the latter half of the 19th century and gave us our 40th president. I wasn't so sure about her story, but I wasn't about to say my ma was telling tales. Besides, I liked the notion of somehow being related to someone who would turn out to be one of our greatest presidents. She was an identical twin, and with seven older brothers and sisters of her own, it was quite a circus when the family came together. I was born in 1964 and grew up during this period with my three younger sisters, Patty, Donna, and Beth Ann. The Vietnam War was ending. The local economy was crumbling, but at least the Pittsburgh Steelers were winning. I attended public school and played varsity sports year-round. In western Pennsylvania, that meant football, basketball, and track. I was a B+, A- student, but never made the National Honor Society. My life would change, however, when I came across a school catalog for West Point in my guidance counselor's office. I didn't come from a military family, far from it, and with no major bases nearby, there was little connection to the armed forces. I did, however, read military history, watch classic World War II movies like Patton and The Longest Day, and play soldier with my friends in the backyard, but that was it. As I read that catalog, West Point called to me with its pictures of cadets in gray uniforms, promises of military training in the summer and engineering classes in the fall, not to mention the appeal of serving my country as an officer and gentleman. The adventure, the challenge, and the academy motto of duty, honor, country, all resonated deep within me. I knew immediately it was where I had to go, where I needed to be. West Point was the only college to which I would apply. A little over a year later, in July 1982, with freshly cut hair, an awkwardly worn uniform, and my first hectic day nearly under my new belt, I raised my right hand and swore my first oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies. More than 1,000 other young, scared men and women from across the land would join me on that large, grassy field known as the Plain that hot summer day. It was an important moment for all of us. The long, gray line would continue. My 4 years at West Point provided the foundation that would allow me, decades later, to stand up against a president who undermined our nation's institutions and traditions, had little respect for the truth or propriety, and put himself above everything else. The Academy's purpose of developing leaders of character who valued integrity, put country and mission first, and, as the cadet prayer asked God to do, make us to choose the harder right instead of the easier wrong, all ran counter to Donald J. Trump's way of doing business. My many years of public service in uniform and out, in the United States and abroad, in wartime and peace, constantly reinforced the importance of the timeless values drilled into us at West Point. They were fully internalized long before I ever returned to the Pentagon and public service in 2017, and well before I would continually face off against the 45th President of the United States. This moral, ethical, and professional compass would guide me as I took on one of the most demanding jobs during one of the most difficult epochs in one of the most tumultuous administrations in American history, and it would make all the difference in the world. Chapter 1. First Days, Early Warnings. When President Trump came to office in January 2017, war with North Korea was a real possibility. I didn't fully realize this as I went through the confirmation process to become the 23rd Army Secretary, nor did I fully appreciate that Trump was playing carelessly with the matches that could ignite a conflict, one the world hadn't seen since the last war in Korea. It would be at least that bad. The Senate confirmed me as Secretary of the Army in mid-November by an 89-6 vote. I was grateful for what would become increasingly rare bipartisan support, and was sworn into office on November 21, 2017. I had worked on Capitol Hill for many years, particularly in the Senate, handled a range of policy issues in the private sector as well, traveled extensively abroad in both capacities to meet with foreign leaders and address issues up close, and of course, served in the military. As such, I brought a great deal of defense, foreign policy, and business experience to the position, more than 2 decades at this point, not counting my time on active duty. I knew many of the senators, so I also believed the vote reflected a reputation I had built for being bipartisan, even-keeled, and reasonable. I considered myself a traditional Republican with conventional views, a fiscal conservative, social moderate, and defense hawk who believed in free but fair trade, protecting the environment, legal immigration, and limited government, who worked across the aisle. Stepping into the Secretary of the Army's historic office on the second floor of the Pentagon's E-ring was like coming home. I remember as a young captain working in the War Plans office on the Army staff in the mid-1990s that the Secretary's office then was hallowed ground. The highest I traveled in those days was to brief the 3-star head of Army Operations. Yet here I was, 21 years later, sitting behind the large, ornate Taft desk, with pictures of General George C. Marshall, my hometown hero, staring down on me. I felt privileged to serve my country once again. It was hard to imagine. The key to success in any organization, and especially at the most senior levels, is getting the right team aligned and working together. Fate gave me Ryan McCarthy as the Army Undersecretary, General Mark Milley as the Army Chief of Staff, and General Jim McConville as the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army. This lineup would make all the difference and was key to everything the four of us would accomplish in our 19 months together. What each person brought to the team spoke volumes about how quickly we could deliberate, discuss, decide, and act. Ryan McCarthy grew up in the Chicago area and attended the Virginia Military Institute. After college, he commissioned in the infantry and later served with the Army Rangers in Afghanistan. He then spent several years in the private sector and had a brief stint on Capitol Hill before reporting to the Pentagon to work as a special assistant to Secretary of Defense Bob Gates for a few years. In 2011, he left the DoD to take a senior role in the defense industry, before becoming Army Undersecretary 6 years later in his mid-40s. Of medium height and build with a close-cropped haircut, Ryan leaned into the challenges we faced together. Whenever a problem arose, he would always pull me aside quietly, lean forward, and quietly say, "Mr. Secretary, I need to talk to you about something." I valued his ability to identify problems early, tease them out, and then propose solutions to get them fixed. Jim McConville rounded out the Army's leadership team. He hailed from Quincy, Massachusetts, graduated from West Point in 1981, and became an aviator soon thereafter. With blue eyes that squinted as he spoke in his thick Boston accent, McConville commanded at multiple levels, served in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and distinguished himself as the longest-serving and one of the most capable combat commanders of the 101st Airborne Division. McConville also brought valuable Pentagon experience to the job, having served previously as the head of Army Personnel, G1, and the chief of legislative liaison. McConville's and Milley's paths in the Army had crossed many times in the past, so they already had a strong working relationship. The most important relationship, however, is the one between the secretary and the chief of staff. There is a large, heavy wooden door that separates the secretary's and the chief's offices. It is a physical metaphor for their relationship. There are horror stories of past occupants who openly bickered or never spoke to each other. File cabinets, large potted plants, or anything else that could obstruct this passageway often blocked the door during these times. The Army would suffer as a result, with the civilians and uniformed personnel drawing battle lines on what is otherwise an integrated staff. Milley and I made a different commitment: to keep the door open. Over time, we would take it to a new level, often transiting back and forth between each other's office multiple times a day to discuss issues, share information, or plot a way forward on some tough matter. It was a close relationship we would carry forward as Secretary of Defense and Chairman, and one that few understood or appreciated. It made our relationship unique in the history of defense secretaries and chairmen, I suppose. McCarthy, Milley, McConville and I realized early on the special chemistry among the four of us that could give us the chance to do big things, long overdue and necessary things, with the Army. We just needed to stay focused on the mission and work together. We had some common bonds that facilitated this. We all served in the Army. We were all combat arms officers. All four of us had deployed and been in combat. And we were all willing to do what was necessary to improve the Army's readiness and position the force for the future. The only thing that divided us was that both Milley and McConville were from Boston and Patriots fans, and I was from the Pittsburgh area and favored the Steelers. Counting Super Bowl wins and who had won or lost each week became important. More seriously, we sometimes spent time together outside of work, often joined by our wives. In many ways, it had the feel of being junior officers again in a battalion, committed to the team, focused on the mission, and having fun doing both. When I arrived in November, however, our focus wasn't on the Army's future. The immediate challenge was the situation on the Korean Peninsula, the readiness of our forces in South Korea, and the very real prospect of war with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or DPRK, as the North is more formally known. In July 2017, 4 months before I took office, North Korea launched its first missile capable of reaching the United States. If they were able to mount a nuclear weapon atop one of them, then this was a very serious threat. U.S. Forces Korea in Seoul took reciprocal actions intended to send a warning message to Kim Jong-un, the DPRK's young authoritarian leader, but it failed to deter further firings. North Korea would continue missile launches into the fall and added a nuclear test in early September. As the public rhetoric between Trump and Kim increased and sharpened, planning and preparations ticked up at the Pentagon, and military options were fine-tuned. North Korean officials would call Trump Mr. Evil President, as Trump dubbed Kim Little Rocket Man. This name-calling was petty and dangerous, doing nothing to resolve the differences between our countries. Tensions continued into the fall. A week after my arrival in late November, North Korea conducted another missile test. General Milley had been holding near-weekly readiness meetings with the Army staff to ensure the units programmed to fight in Korea were fully prepared. We were also participating in field exercises, computer simulations, and all manner of training events in South Korea with our allies. The Army was also quietly sending leaders from U.S.-based combat units on temporary duty to walk the operational area where they might be deployed. It was all very real and very serious, and Milley and McCarthy, as acting Secretary of the Army pending my confirmation, had done a solid job in the months leading up to my arrival to get ready. We still had a lot of work to do, though, and it wasn't solely about combat units either. We had to procure and ship munitions to the theater, rehearse evacuation plans for civilians, exercise our communications networks, and ensure our logistical systems, which would move everything from ammunition, food, spare parts, and other items forward, to backhauling casualties, damaged equipment, and other items rearward, would function in the heat of battle. I worked on the war plan 22 years earlier, so it was a little strange and unsettling to see it being updated and rehearsed with such urgency. In late January, about 2 months after becoming the Secretary of the Army, I traveled to Redstone Arsenal in Huntsville, Alabama. I wanted to see and discuss a few things there, but my primary purpose was to meet with General Gus Perna, the head of U.S. Army Material Command, and eventual Chief Operating Officer for Operation Warp Speed, to understand better the Army's logistical preparations and readiness for war with North Korea. I was sitting with Perna in his office when an urgent call from the Pentagon interrupted our meeting. What could this be? I asked myself. The person on the other end informed me that the president was ordering a withdrawal of all U.S. military dependents from South Korea, and he was going to announce it that afternoon. I couldn't believe it. I asked if something had happened in Korea. Did Kim shoot a missile at Hawaii? Were North Korean armored units moving to the DMZ? Did they sink an American ship? Did Pyongyang fire a ballistic missile at the United States? What? Only a few weeks before, Trump and Kim were taunting each other about the capabilities of their respective nuclear arsenals. It was the American president who would spook the world on January 3, 2018 with a series of tweets, culminating in one that said, "Will someone from his, Kim's, depleted and food-starved regime please inform him that I too have a nuclear button, but it is a much bigger and more powerful one than his, and my button works." And now we had a possible evacuation order. There was nothing to explain it. There was nothing to warrant it. I asked them to check with the SecDef's office, follow up on these core questions, and to start leaning into the problem. I would call back in an hour for an update with key leaders. I set down the phone and told Perna the news. He was stunned too. There were more than 28,000 U.S. military personnel stationed in Korea, plus another 7,000 family members. Evacuating them all, along with 11,000 other DOD non-combatants, would be a challenging task. I had visited our troops there 2 weeks earlier. The command briefed me on their war preparations, which included plans to evacuate all Americans from South Korea, a number that approached close to 190,000 people. It was a daunting task that was complicated and overwhelming, and which would take far longer than anyone preferred. The message I just received gave me no sense of timing for evacuating our families, but this was small potatoes compared to the bigger issue at hand. Evacuating all American military family members was such an unexpected and dramatic move that many would likely interpret it that war was on the horizon, if not imminent. It would probably trigger a panic that would affect the South Korean economy, its stock market, air transportation, and a range of other things. U.S. citizens in Korea would want to leave as well and likely request U.S. government assistance. Many other countries would probably follow suit, which would heighten the sense of panic throughout Korea and the region. Most importantly, what would North Korea think? Kim would probably view a U.S. evacuation as a prelude to conflict. Even if he was unsure, prudence would demand he put his military on alert, get his ships to sea, and disperse his aircraft. Therefore, the critical question asked how exactly Kim would react. Would he stand down? Negotiate? Conduct more missile tests? Call for snap military exercises? Or would he strike first, targeting Seoul in a bloody assault? Maybe even seize the city of 10 million and then sue for peace before the United States could act with sufficient force? Would this be like the beginning of World War I, where we all stumble into a bloody years-long conflict? Nobody knew, but this was a dangerous game of chicken, and with nuclear roosters no less. If the president was going to announce an evacuation, then we needed to be ready for war. As quickly as the warning found its way to me in Alabama, it also went away. I never received a clear explanation, but apparently somebody talked the president out of sending the tweet announcing the evacuation of Americans from South Korea. Crisis averted. War avoided. I was dumbfounded at the time as to what was happening and why there was this back-and-forth decision-making over a matter of such import and consequence. My experiences later as Secretary of Defense enabled me to imagine someone on the White House staff, or maybe even a talking head on Fox News, goading the president into action, a series of moves that could lead to the outbreak of war. I would have to wrestle with and navigate these dynamics for 18 months. Too many people played too often to the president's whims, and it seemed that too few were willing to consider the second, third, and fourth order consequences. This wasn't simply Trump pushing over one domino, but possibly a series of black tiles that led in different directions, with other players, such as North Korea or China, able to tumble other sets of dominoes, maybe even more troubling ones. As such, these things needed careful deliberation, with Congress and our allies, but that simply wasn't how this White House tended to operate. War with North Korea remained the top international concern for me during my tenure as Army Secretary, followed closely by Afghanistan, as it was my job to make sure our ground combat units were manned, trained, equipped, and prepared for what would be a bloody and violent fight. Who knew when another doomsday tweet might come? We had to be ready. Fortunately, tensions in Northeast Asia with North Korea began easing in early 2018 once Trump took a more diplomatic approach toward Kim. Nuclear testing stopped, as did long-range missile tests. This new tone would culminate in the very first meeting between the leaders of North Korea and the United States in Singapore in June 2018. Many complained that Trump gave Kim what he wanted, a high-profile meeting that raised his stature and received nothing in return. That is true in many ways, but Trump's engagement did get us off the war path and kept things under control through the end of his term. That was a good thing. I had watched Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama try similar approaches dating back to the early 1990s with no real effect. Why not try a different diplomatic tack, especially when nuclear weapons are on the table? With the early drama of a forced emergency withdrawal of American family members and government workers from the Korean Peninsula behind me, I focused on writing a clear, concise, two-page vision statement for where I wanted to take the Army during my tenure, and then developing the plans to implement it. We had to get the Army in much better shape and ready for the difficult future we saw ahead of us, especially if it meant a fight against China or Russia. Chapter 2. An Army Renaissance. For years, the war had lasted. Americans were killed and wounded in the thousands. People were tired. With the conflict behind them, the last thing they wanted to think about was preparing for the next fight. Nevertheless, on January 8, 1790, President George Washington delivered his first annual message to Congress. Washington had learned some important lessons about war and peace over his lifetime. He told Congress, "To be prepared for war is one of the most effectual means of preserving peace." Washington was no warmonger. He had seen more death and destruction than anyone should. However, to ensure the young nation's security, he understood the importance of having a ready and capable force that could defeat its enemies and thus deter the malign intentions of others in the first place. Nearly 200 years later, another great American president, Ronald Reagan, would capture Washington's maxim in the simple and eloquent policy of peace through strength. It would be our 40th president's guiding principle as he rebuilt the U.S. military in the 1980s to confront the Soviet Union. As a result, the Cold War would end less than a decade after Reagan's inauguration. In 2017, nearly 30 years after staring down the Soviets and defeating the world's fourth-largest military in the 1991 Gulf War, the U.S. Army wasn't well prepared for war against the countries that could do us the most harm. In fact, while China and Russia modernized their armed forces to defeat ours, our high-end warfighting advantages eroded. After 16 years of conflict in Afghanistan and Iraq, the continuous back-and-forth deployment of brigade combat teams to places like Europe and the Middle East, and a dramatic reduction in annual defense dollars over several years, the Army was tired, broken, and old. We were still very capable, but we weren't where we needed to be. Nor were we on the right path to preserve the peace, fight and win against the likes of China, and maintain America's role in the world for the next 30 years. Once General Mark Milley became Army Chief of Staff in August 2015, he made readiness his top priority. At the time, the Army's non-deployable rate, meaning the percentage of soldiers unable to go to war, was an unacceptably high 15%. 5% or lower is a solid mark to hit. Moreover, out of 58 total brigade combat teams, the standard warfighting maneuver unit of the Army, the number considered fully ready was in the single digits. These units, which averaged 4,000 to 5,000 soldiers each, needed to be above 50%. Times were tough, and the future didn't look better. Meanwhile, the Army was still heavily reliant on the foundational combat systems of the Reagan buildup decades earlier. The Abrams tank, Bradley fighting vehicle, Apache attack helicopter, Black Hawk utility helicopter, and Patriot air defense system. Army leaders improved them all over the years, but upgrades can only go so far. The service tried in the past to introduce new systems, but failed miserably with projects such as the Crusader Mobile Artillery System and the Future Combat System family of vehicles. The department wasted billions of dollars with little or nothing to show for all the money and effort. Acquisition of major end items had a terrible legacy. It was the result of bureaucracy, an insatiable appetite to add an insufferable number of requirements to a program, inefficient processes, and a weak business culture. The Army had become really good at fighting insurgents and terrorists over the last 16 years. To meet the demands of the times, the types of combat units critical to winning wars against threats like North Korea, let alone China and Russia, heavy armor, artillery, and air defense, for example, had to learn to fight like the light infantry. For many, the daily tasks of maintenance, gunnery, and maneuver training went by the wayside. Fighting as a combined arms team atrophied. Being concerned about enemy aircraft, electronic surveillance, and long-range missiles waned. The last decade and a half was about counterterrorism, convoy security, foot patrols, and running checkpoints. To make matters worse, the Army lowered recruiting standards at times. This would solve the immediate manpower shortage problems resulting from the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, but created deeper challenges down the road when it came to maintaining readiness, good order, and discipline. Ryan McCarthy and I arrived in 2017, and with McConville and Milley as our uniformed counterparts, began mapping out plans to address all these issues and more, even before we were confirmed. An emphasis for Secretary of Defense James Mattis was improving the readiness and lethality of the armed forces. President Trump would deliver on his plan to increase funding for the military, and with Congress's help, this would continue for 3 good years. We knew if we did anything with these much-needed dollars, we had to keep improving current readiness while effecting a dramatic shift to modernize the force. By the end of my first 6 months as Army Secretary, I had written a new vision statement for the Army. For the 2018 Army vision, see Appendix A in the enhancement. General Milley co-signed it with me to demonstrate that the Army's civilian and military leaders were equally committed to the path charted. Both a clear vision and the partnership had been lacking for years. In two short pages, I covered not only what we wanted to achieve by 2028, but also the ways and means to get there. The vision emphasized the centrality of the American soldier and their leaders, and the importance we placed on remaining committed to and living by the Army's values. We also spoke to the need to grow the force to more than 500,000 active duty soldiers. This would not only give us greater capacity, but also allow us to reduce the strains on our soldiers and their families by spreading the burden of frequent deployments. A deployment cycle typically alternated between a 9-month tour abroad, followed by an 18-month stay at home, and then another 9-month deployment. The military shorthand for this cycle is called the deploy-to-dwell ratio. In numerical terms, we wanted to achieve a ratio of 1 to 3, and no less than 1 to 2 for active duty forces, and higher for the National Guard and Army Reserve in order to sustain readiness. To improve further our soldiers' professional experience and quality of life, we planned to implement a new market-based, talent-centric personnel system that would better optimize the Army's manpower pool. This initiative would go a long way to retaining more of our service members by giving them greater say when it came to where they worked, what they did, and how often they moved. The vision made clear that we now faced a new range of future threats, beginning with China, and that we had to focus training on high-intensity combat operations under the constant surveillance that would mark conflict with the People's Liberation Army. This type of warfare was on the other end of how we had fought the last 16-plus years, low-intensity warfare, so it would be a dramatic and overdue shift. The challenges we cited in making this shift began with the fact that technological change was accelerating and that we would face continued downward pressure on our budget. We are seeing that today. As such, I wanted to prepare the Army to pursue needed reforms that would free up time, money, and manpower to put back into our top priorities. Moreover, to be successful, the vision affirmed our objective of standing up a new command that would focus Army acquisition to modernize the force, our biggest challenge. The vision statement would be the roadmap for the Army's renaissance. We would also use it as a yardstick to measure our progress. I'm proud to say that we started the ball rolling on all the major items included in the vision and accomplished many of them in the time we had. However, it wasn't easy, especially with everything else occurring in the world and in Washington, D.C. In 2018, the U.S. Army failed to meet its recruiting goals. This was the first time it happened in over a dozen years. It was easy to attribute the misfire to a very strong job market, which typically works against the armed services when it comes to recruiting 18-year-olds graduating from high school, but there were other issues at play. The Army probably reached too high the year prior by trying to grow too fast, failing to recognize the challenge presented by an expanding economy that offered America's youth more opportunities. By the time I arrived in November 2017, the Army's active duty personnel target was 483,000, which translated into an annual recruiting goal of 80,000. Congress lowered that number further, but the Army still came up short. It was troubling to learn what the data and people outside of Washington told me as I dug into the problem. We were sacrificing quality for quantity. Too many recruits received waivers for histories of drug use, bad conduct, breaking the law, medical problems, or even mental health issues. All this did was create problems down the road. To me, quality took priority over quantity any day of the week, even if that meant a smaller army. Therefore, if we were to meet all of our recruiting goals, we needed to be more innovative and commit more resources. More importantly, the answer wasn't to lower standards. People want to believe they are part of something special, something elite, if not unique. Our answer was to raise the standards. Traditionally, 95% or more of Army enlistees are high school graduates, the top category. Two-thirds score in the top half in verbal and mathematical aptitudes. However, the DoD allows up to 4% of recruits to come from the lowest tier, Category 4. We immediately cut that in half, allowing no more than 2%. Further, a failed drug test now meant automatic disqualification. We also removed prospective recruits with indications of mental health issues, such as self-mutilation or suicide attempts, as well as young people who committed serious crimes. These actions and others mostly took care of my quality concerns. We were also conscious of extremism in any form entering our ranks. The Army carefully screens new recruits for any tattoos or body markings that suggest membership in or support for extremist organizations. We also conduct social media and other background checks as warranted. The Army had some bad experiences in the past, and every year would come across a small number of cases. We worked hard to keep those corrosive views and behaviors out of our ranks by swiftly dealing with these cases. We expected America's soldiers to be committed to one organization, the U.S. Army, loyal to their fellow service members, regardless of race, ethnicity, and gender, committed to defending the country, and sworn to an oath of supporting the U.S. Constitution. It was that simple. When it came to missing our recruiting numbers, we were also late to discover the serious problems in our recruiting operations, beginning at the Pentagon. We uncovered issues of mismanagement, poor leadership, and squandered dollars that caught the attention of lawmakers on Capitol Hill. Some marketing ideas had very low returns on investment. All of this prompted us to investigate and eventually conduct a complete overhaul of the operation. This took months and months to sort out, and in the meantime, our recruiting was suffering. Eventually, the team brought forward a series of recommendations to completely transform our recruiting operations, including hiring a different marketing firm, initiating a new ad campaign, and making other changes that would at least get us even with our competition, the other armed services. We were also facing some alarming demographic changes in the country that were a warning sign for me, and should be for the nation's leaders. Studies were telling us that 71% of the 34 million 17 to 24-year-olds in the United States could not meet the military's entry requirements, most often due to obesity, drugs, physical and mental health problems, misconduct, or aptitude. Worse yet, only around 1% of the population that could qualify, the other 29%, had some interest in serving. When you did the math, it meant that the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines were all competing for the same 300,000 to 400,000 young Americans. Therefore, when you throw in the fact that our marketing, branding, and appeal seemed weaker than the other services, the Army was in a bad position. We were also sensing declining support among parents and other influencers, teachers, counselors, coaches, pastors, for their children to join the Army, which we attributed to the long wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and too many TV shows, stories, and movies portraying service members as broken heroes who wrestled with severe combat injuries and PTSD. It wasn't accurate, and it had a negative effect. We knew that if we were to stay ahead of the trend lines, we had to shift the narrative and change our game. This meant overhauling our marketing campaign to portray more of the non-combat skills, such as medical technicians, mechanics, cooks, truck drivers that the Army needed and that were often less dangerous, more interesting, or provided a better transition to the civilian job market for young people. It meant going online in all forms of social media and requiring recruiters to use Instagram, moves that would pay off in 2020 once COVID shut down many recruiting offices. It meant reducing TV ads in favor of targeted advertising on Facebook and Twitch. It also meant putting money behind unconventional ideas coming out of recruiting command that would make the service look cooler and more appealing, from the creation of a competitive Army CrossFit team to the establishment of an Army esports cadre that would participate in online competitions. As I pushed this notion of an Army renaissance, we all believed that reinstating the World War II-era pinks and greens uniform, the iconic Army attire of the Greatest Generation, would be a big morale booster for the force. It would remind everyone of our tremendous history, help burnish the Army's appeal, and strengthen our connections to society. Dan Daly, the Sergeant Major of the Army, was the real leader on this initiative. He made the case that we should issue this classic uniform to our recruiters first. Daly was right. One of my favorite days as Army Secretary was approving the return of this historic uniform. The composition of our recruiting teams also needed to change to give them local appeal with local knowledge. This meant getting our sergeants and officers in recruiting command back to the towns, cities, and states where they grew up, I spoke with a recruiter once in Boston who was originally from New York City. He wanted to be assigned to his old stomping grounds, but a colleague of his, who was from Boston, ironically, was already there. You would think we could simply swap them out. We also needed more women in recruiting and more people of color. I met once with the recruiting team responsible for the broader Denver area. We had only one woman for that entire metro region at the time. Go figure. It wasn't all bad, though. When I visited a recruiting headquarters in Los Angeles, I was pleased to see that the command was quite diverse. Finally, our efforts needed to expand across the country and across demographics. We viewed ourselves as America's army, and if that was the case, then we needed to represent better our fellow citizens we swore an oath to defend. Yet we faced, and still do, some troubling facts. To begin, nearly 80% of recruits have a relative who served, which suggests military service has become somewhat of a family business. And second, an inordinate number of recruits, 41%, come from the South. We needed to broaden our recruiting base. In the fall of 2018, we developed a 22-city initiative, which meant going to nearly 24 of America's largest cities to recruit, going to where the young people are, especially urban areas where many high school graduates were looking for more and different opportunities. By doing this, we would broaden our reach into other regions and into many states that didn't have as much identification with or exposure to the U.S. military. We realized it would take time, but we needed to start somewhere, sometime, before the recruiting pool became too narrow, too regional, and too hard. The Army's leaders fanned out to many of these urban areas. I personally visited cities ranging from Boston and Pittsburgh to Cleveland and Atlanta, and to Denver and Los Angeles. The purpose was to hear from our recruiters on the ground, to speak with mayors, governors, and other leaders, and to spend time with local media at each stop. After nearly 2 years of effort, the Army saw a 15% annual increase in recruiting from these cities from where we began in 2017. It was a good start. Taking a long-term perspective, I said at the time, and still believe today, that one of the greatest challenges facing our country going forward will be ensuring a strong bond between the less than 1% of the U.S. population that serves in uniform and the other 99% we are sworn to defend. With fewer and fewer young Americans both able to serve and interested in military duty, with our recruiting pools not well represented across the country, and with service becoming more of a family business, we risk a military increasingly isolated from the broader American public it serves. We need a national effort, led by our elected leaders, sports figures, celebrities, entertainers, and other well-known influencers, to join with the armed forces and help address these trends. This side of the civilian-military relationship coin is too important and too consequential to risk. In my multiple jobs at the Pentagon over a quarter century, the position of Army Secretary was by far the most fun, the most productive, and the most rewarding. Having the opportunity to be back among young soldiers one day and to turn around and make decisions that will shape the Army for decades the next was quite the joy and privilege. Leah felt the same way. We had the chance to leverage our experiences from my 21 years in uniform to make a difference for the soldiers and their families. Leah was by my side through thick and thin to help move things forward, whether it was improving job opportunities for spouses, expanding childcare capacity, or simply ensuring new moms received the recuperation time they needed in Army hospitals after giving birth. She was the voice and conscience of Army families for me, and I'll be forever grateful for the time she spent with me in D.C. and on the road meeting with spouses, taking issue briefs, and developing new ways to take better care of the families. Unit readiness is largely shaped by four factors: having enough time and resources to train for your assigned tasks, ensuring the right number and type of soldiers are in your units, possessing the correct numbers and types of equipment, and maintaining a sufficient level of serviceability of that equipment. The confluence of all these assessments, plus a commander's evaluation, constitutes a unit's readiness level. In early 2017, only a few out of the 31 active duty brigade combat teams were fully ready to deploy. To quickly improve this, we dug into every element of readiness. Mandatory training. The classes and instruction, often directed from above, including from Congress, had grown ridiculously high since I commanded an infantry company in the early 1990s. It now took the typical unit at least 40 days to complete all this instruction. I served in both Army National Guard and Army Reserve units as well. If you are a traditional reservist, you only have about 38 days in a normal year to begin with to train. How were the Guard and Reserve going to find time for their unit training if they had to complete nearly 6 weeks of required individual training first? It was impossible. Some of these mandates were completely unnecessary. Most gave commanders little say in how to adapt the training, if at all, to their unique situation. It also frustrated our soldiers. We asked them to be willing to fight and die for their country in wartime, and then we treated them like children in peace. However, this is what happens when higher headquarters tries to manage centrally from the top down, and often does so in reaction or overreaction to an incident or trend. One of my favorite examples of BS training and unnecessary requirements was a program called the Travel Risk Planning System, or TRIPS. Over the years, well-intended bureaucrats eager to help reduce accidents associated with soldiers doing normal stuff, such as taking road trips or driving home over a long weekend, developed this checklist to help soldiers assess their weekend plans. Every person was required to do a TRIPS assessment, even if you lived in a nearby town and wanted to visit your parents. Nearly all were complaining about TRIPS. It had become a monster. I never had to deal with it during my time in the service. It was the sergeant's job back then to know when his or her soldiers were taking leave or a weekend pass and then discuss their plans with them as necessary. So on a long plane flight overseas once, I asked my staff to pull up the TRIPS program online so that I could apply for a weekend pass. I wanted to see if it was as bad as the troops were telling me. I logged in and began the series of questions. 13 minutes later, the system denied my pass and instructed me to see my chain of command. TRIPS died that day. We eliminated several dozen mandatory training, inspection, reporting, and other requirements beginning in the spring of 2018. It had a big effect on training time and in the confidence we were expressing in our junior leaders, but it still took a while to get the bureaucracy to purge these programs and this tendency from the system. Too many people don't like change, and many more are afraid to take a little managed risk. We then worked hard to improve collective training, which is military jargon for when everyone trains together as a team. The National Training Center, NTC, was the Army's premier training site, with thousands of acres of open land in the California desert for Army brigades to go head-to-head in a mock war fight for 2+ weeks against a heavy armored force that fought like the Russians. Developed in the 1970s to prepare the Army to fight the Soviets, it was the next best thing to actual combat. I had gone through an NTC rotation as a lieutenant in the 101st Airborne Division decades earlier, so I understood the demands it placed on units. Most would agree that the NTC was critical to the Army's swift defeat of the fourth largest army in the world during Operation Desert Storm in 1991. However, over the last 10 years, the NTC adapted its program to meet the needs of units deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan. There weren't nearly as many high-intensity rotations as in the past, and certainly nowhere near enough as we entered this era of great power competition with China and Russia. The plan was to return to these types of heavy operations, with lessons learned from the Russians' actions in Ukraine, for example, incorporating the use of drones, and elsewhere, and then completely max out the number of rotations to the NTC. These are a few of the major initiatives we pushed, and when coupled with a significant increase in training dollars and other actions, such as personnel policy changes to keep units together longer, the number of brigade combat teams fully ready to deploy by late 2018 had increased 400%. After graduating from West Point, I had attended the Infantry Officer Basic Course at Fort Benning, Georgia for about 5 months. The course prepared me to lead a 40-plus man platoon. Ranger school awaited me after that. It was there that I learned a great deal about leadership and infantry tactics. It built upon my earlier graduation from airborne school to become a paratrooper, and later Pathfinder School, Air Assault School, and much later, jungle training. I had nearly a year of individual schooling under my belt before I took command of my first platoon in the spring of 1987. I was well prepared to do my job, but the same wasn't true for our newest soldiers, which was obvious when they arrived at their first duty assignment. Too often, many of these young privates would show up at their initial unit underprepared to meet the demands of an active duty Army Brigade combat team. Many weren't fit enough, didn't possess all the right skills, and usually didn't understand tactics well. This placed a burden on the sergeants now responsible for them. It would take a lot of time and hard work to get them ready. General Milley and I had a different vision, a simple one. Ensuring that our newest soldiers were ready to deploy the week they arrived at their first assignment. To do this, we would have to overhaul basic training and add more money and people. It would end up being the biggest change to basic and advanced infantry training since 1974 and a big part of our renaissance. The results were impressive. Achieving our goal meant extending basic and advanced training by over 50% to 22 weeks. Which made it one of the longest, if not the longest, in the world. Initial reports in early 2019 showed a 50% reduction in attrition and injuries, with significant improvements in physical fitness, land navigation, and marksmanship skills. The additional training time and a significant reduction in the drill sergeant to trainee ratio drove these results. In November 2018, I went to Fort Benning to observe the new program up close. The trainees were employing all infantry weapons, conducting hand-to-hand combatives training, and performing a variety of other tasks critical to modern warfare. I watched from a catwalk 12 feet above a series of ceilingless rooms as groups of four young infantrymen stacked against a concrete wall readied themselves and then conducted a live-fire clearing of multiple rooms. It was incredible. As the rifles of entering soldiers fired one round after another with precision at the targets, they looked more like experienced professionals than they did new recruits. They could have fought side by side on day one with the paratroopers I once led. There is a great deal of excitement regarding this change. I would learn months later that the active duty units assigned this new batch of soldiers were equally impressed. The reports I received said they quickly integrated because they were as fit as the old hands, were proficient on nearly every weapon, understood tactics, and had mastered basic soldier skills. This was a sea change. We decided quickly to expand basic training for other branches, such as armor and cavalry. While the changes to basic and advanced training would take time to propagate throughout the force, the physical fitness training we incorporated into the new infantry basic and advanced training proved itself out and promised its own renaissance in combat fitness for the entire Army. Since 1980, the Army used the three-event Army Physical Fitness Test, APFT, consisting of push-ups, sit-ups, and a 2-mile run to gauge soldiers' fitness. It was a simple test that could be administered anywhere, but it wasn't too hard to prepare for or excel on. Most troubling, though, was that it had little correlation to the fitness needed by soldiers in wartime. This had to change. Years before my arrival as Army Secretary, the service began experimenting with a replacement for the APFT that would be based on our wartime experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, more than 100 critical warrior tasks and drills required of soldiers, and modern fitness regimens. We also had good data on how, where, and why soldiers suffered physical injuries. For example, we knew that musculoskeletal injuries, broken bones, muscle strains, and cartilage tears, prompted more battlefield evacuations than enemy action. We were seeing similar things during training. Many of these injuries, which reduced deployability and combat power on the ground in war zones, were preventable through proper technique training, practice, and strengthening. As such, an improved fitness regimen could help units maintain higher levels of readiness, effectiveness, and deployability. Born from these studies and assessments was the Army Combat Fitness Test. ACFT. The 6-event ACFT would mimic the skills, movements, and other physical tasks associated with combat and would measure attributes such as power, agility, endurance, and speed. Whereas the current APFT was only around 30% relevant to combat movements and tasks, the ACFT was well over 70%. We also made the test both age and gender neutral, with performance standards pegged to the soldier's military occupational specialty. This was consistent with direction given to us by Congress, a fact seemingly disregarded by a couple of liberal senators who have worked to delay the ACFT's implementation and lower its standards. Nonetheless, the new test reflected the realities of the modern battlefield and resonated well with our younger soldiers. We knew that many could meet the test's high standards, and with hard work and proper training, nearly all should be able to do so. I saw several personal examples of that happening to make me confident in this decision. A female sergeant on my staff who probably weighed no more than 110 pounds and who could barely pass the test at first ended up exceeding the infantry standard on a few parts after several months of training. It would just take time, effort, and commitment. The ACFT was only one aspect of our plans to transform the Army's fitness culture. We also wanted to put sports trainers, physical therapists, nutritionists, and other specialists down into our brigades and battalions to help units and individuals be the best they can be. We called this part of the plan Holistic Health and Fitness. It promised to optimize soldier readiness, reduce injury rates, improve rehabilitation after injury, and increase the overall effectiveness of the Army. In short, we looked at the Army as a professional sports team. Tactical athletes, we called them, that needed to understand the importance of nutrition, sleep, strength training, flexibility, and aerobic fitness to be the most lethal and ready players on the modern battlefield. I approved the new fitness test in the summer of 2018 after taking and passing it myself. I was convinced it would deliver on its promises, as would our holistic health and fitness plans. During my tenure as Army Secretary, I traveled around the Army and conducted morning physical training with the troops quite often. Our younger soldiers were generally on board with the new test. Many had grown up doing CrossFit and other high-intensity workouts. Older soldiers were less enthusiastic and concerned, which wasn't a surprise. This would be a major change for them. So we set the implementation date out a couple of years to give everyone sufficient time to train. Nevertheless, at the end of the day, we had to ensure our soldiers were as healthy and fit as modern warfare would demand. To prepare the Army for high-intensity conflict against China and Russia, we also had to begin reshaping the force. The insurgencies of the past 15 years put less emphasis on heavy units such as tank brigades and combat systems such as short-range air defenses and long-range artillery. The most lethal Army ground formation is the Armored Brigade Combat Team, ABCT, which has over 4,500 soldiers, 85 Abrams tanks, and 150 Bradley fighting vehicles. These units carry quite the punch and would lead the fight in a major ground war. Infantry Brigade Combat Teams, IBCTs, could deploy more quickly, but weren't nearly as potent or operationally mobile as an ABCT. Therefore, we began rebalancing our force structure by converting two IBCTs to ABCTs. Meanwhile, we launched new programs to build longer-range artillery systems and mobile air defense battalions, and looked at other ways to make the ABCTs even more robust, such as adding additional mechanized infantry companies to their formations, along with electronic warfare and cyber capabilities. We also worked to resurrect a 4th Corps headquarters that would focus on Europe to improve our command and control and help organize the war planning and preparations of our NATO allies. Despite the need, the Obama administration deactivated V Corps, commonly known as 5th Corps, in Germany in 2013, about 18 months after announcing the withdrawal of two brigades and 7,000 soldiers from Europe. A year later, Russia annexed Crimea and occupied eastern Ukraine. In February 2020, the Army announced the V Corps reactivation and basing at Fort Knox, Kentucky, with a small forward headquarters established months later in Poland. The uncasing of the Corps flag came on the heels of the largest deployment of U.S. forces to Europe in decades. Our NATO allies were happy. So were we. On top of all this, however, we had other changes to make to our force structure and doctrine. We experimented with a new multi-domain task force in the Indo-Pacific designed to counter China by integrating conventional military capabilities with cyber, information, and electronic warfare functions. We also began studying whether and how to restructure our fighting formations. Do we stick with brigade combat teams? Go back to the division structures of the 1980s? Or move to something completely new? These were important issues to dig into if we were going to win in the years to come. By March 2019, we were seeing big increases in readiness. The Army's non-deployable rate shrunk to 6%, and the readiness of our active component brigade combat teams reached a high of 74%, with half of all brigades, both active and guard, considered ready. At the same time, our investments in expanded basic training, new fitness tests and health regimens, more armored brigades, and other changes were showing real promise in reshaping the Army for the future. While the Army knew how to train for combat, it did not have a great track record when it came to modernizing the force. The Reagan buildup in the early 1980s saw the introduction of the so-called Big Five weapons systems designed to defeat the Soviets. These systems crushed the Iraqis twice, yet were still in use more than three decades since their introduction. The service needed a new mix of speed, lethality, survivability, and mobility that only modern technologies, such as robotics and AI, could provide. To avoid the abysmal failures of the past, we also needed a new acquisition system that could deliver. This was the backdrop behind the Army's six modernization priorities and the establishment of Army Futures Command, AFC. Both were critical pillars in this renaissance we were working to effect. General Milley was the natural leader for advancing readiness through training. However, when it came to modernization, Ryan McCarthy shined. He really immersed himself in the issue, bringing the right combination of enthusiasm, knowledge, experience, and determination to the task. In 2018, we made the biggest change in the Army's structure in over four decades, since 1973, when we established the AFC in Austin, Texas. With McCarthy in the lead, we had spent months going over the organizational purpose and structure, the roles and responsibilities, the systems and processes, and all the way down to how we would choose the cross-functional teams to lead each of our modernization priorities. I also had to select the commander, which ended up being the very capable General Mike Murray. For the first time in the Army's history, one commander was driving concept development, requirements determination, organizational design, science and technology research, and solution development. This change didn't come easy, however. We had a lot of resistance from within the Army, including from some of our acquisition professionals, who saw this as a threat to their programs and prerogatives. When some didn't get their way, they went to the Hill or leaked to the press all the nefarious reasons that Futures Command would fail and how it would harm the service. It was a lot of bunk, and it caused unnecessary delays and friction. One of the reasons so many major Army programs failed in the past was that the acquisition system itself was broken. It wasn't due to a lack of good ideas, able professionals, or extraordinary effort. We had all of that. But overall, the acquisition system was risk-averse, prone to say no to new ideas and yes to more process, and constantly demonstrating that classic bureaucratic tendency to protect turf and budget. At the end of the day, however, it was Army capability and soldier effectiveness that paid the price for this behavior. Another issue we had to sort through was the constant tension between the demands of today and the needs of tomorrow. Modernization had suffered in the past because those organizations charged with thinking about future war and its requirements became burdened with today's problems, such as combat operations in Iraq or the conflict in Afghanistan. In short, the present was constantly elbowing out the future. To address this dynamic, it was decided when we created AFC that all of those organizations responsible for future warfare, identifying enemy tech trends and investments, studying advanced operational concepts, and so on, would be assigned to AFC and would not be allowed to work on current problems. Futures Command could work only on issues and programs beyond the 5-year Future Years Defense Program. It wasn't a hard black line, but it was a very good demarcation point to protect the future from the present, and vice versa. To guide AFC's work, the Army established a clear set of modernization priorities that we publicly committed to not change. During my many years on Capitol Hill and in the defense industry, I saw the service's priorities constantly shifting. This made it hard for the private sector to be a good and helpful partner. One of the things my many years as a senior defense executive taught me was that companies need predictability, clarity, and commitment from the DoD. This means a clear objective, a long-term plan to achieve it, and dedicated funding over several years. With these things, industry is more willing to spend its own money on research and development, hire the right people, retool factories, and do all those things that are essential to competing, winning, and delivering on a contract. When the DoD, or Congress by extension, fails to provide these things, you get more risk, meaning fewer bidders, and all of whom tend to bake more time and cost into their proposals to offset the uncertainty. For the Pentagon, this often means higher prices and schedule slips. Not surprisingly, these were the hallmarks of some of the Army's epic modernization failures. The 6 priorities critical to modernizing the Army were straightforward. First up was long-range precision fires, focused on improving the range, accuracy, and lethality of the cannon artillery and missiles needed in an Indo-Pacific fight. Second was next-generation combat vehicles. A new, optionally manned, tracked combat system to replace the Bradley fighting vehicle. These would be critical in the intense urban warfare we envisioned. Future vertical lift was our third priority. We needed a new helicopter fleet with greater range, speed, and survivability if they were going to fly against Chinese air defenses in the Western Pacific. Fourth up was the Army network. A broad term for ensuring we had a resilient and secure tactical communications network that would work against Russian and Chinese jamming and intercepts, something ISIS and the Taliban never had. Air and missile defense was our fifth priority. Because the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan required more foot soldiers and our enemies didn't have air assets, we cannibalized these units to free up troops and money. This was short-sighted, though, and the Army now needed to rebuild these capabilities. Moreover, in an era of cruise missiles and drone swarms, we needed directed energy systems that could provide a deep and cheap magazine that missiles couldn't offer. Finally, the last of our top 6 modernization priorities was soldier lethality. The infantry usually suffered the largest numbers of casualties on the battlefield. We were committed to changing this by providing our soldiers advanced rifles, next-generation vision systems, and improved body armor. To find the monies necessary to fund our 6 modernization priorities and the 31 programs associated with them, we couldn't rely solely on new funding. The Army vision statement I released in June 2018 made clear we would face budget pressures in the future, and twice said that we would need to make tough decisions when it came to spending. I'm sure many thought these were throwaway lines, but I had been in Washington a long time and understood the budget math when it came to the nation's debt, the annual deficit, and future trends. By early 2021, the national debt was over 100% of gross domestic product at nearly $28 trillion. For years, the federal government has been spending more money each year than what it received, thus creating an annual deficit that accumulated over time into the overall debt. Compounding this problem is the fact that each year, a larger and larger share of federal dollars was going to spending for programs such as Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security as America ages and healthcare costs continue to rise. Moreover, the interest the U.S. government pays to finance this debt is also growing. In 2019, all this so-called mandatory spending, programs based in law that run on autopilot, was over half of government expenditures. With defense spending around 3.3% of GDP and about 15% of all federal spending, it was only a matter of time before these numbers were pushed down even further, all at a moment in history when we needed a solid decade of healthy defense budgets to transform the U.S. military. It was hard to see, though, how sufficient levels of defense spending could be sustained going forward, especially the 3-5% annual real growth in defense dollars, funding that needed to be predictable, adequate, and on time, meaning by the beginning of the new fiscal year, that I was advocating. Meanwhile, China was increasing its defense budget at no less than 6-8% annually. This was the impetus behind my hard push for the Army to reform and make the tough choices. I used to say that the best time to fix your roof was when the sun was out, and during the early Trump years, the weather was great. Mistakenly, that's when most organizations relax and see the problems, if at all, as something in the distance. We needed a way to pressurize the system and apply the heat to find as much money as possible to sustain the renaissance. There might even be the chance to teach the service some better budget habits and hope the lessons and the momentum would endure. When I sat down for my first budget meeting in early 2018, the staff laid out a large sheet of paper filled with a single multicolored box. Inside the box were smaller boxes, with dollar figures coded to the colors of each square or rectangle. It looked like a large game of Tetris with all the colors, sizes, and shapes. As a briefer pointed to the graphic, he told me how much of our annual $182 billion was for people, for operations and maintenance, for military construction, for overseas contingencies, for basic training and modernization, and for healthcare, for example. Sitting upright in his chair, the officer told me what I could adjust, what I couldn't adjust, and what I shouldn't try to adjust. It was tedious and complex, but necessary to understand. Where you put your time and money, after all, says everything about your priorities. Okay, I said when the team finished. How many of our 31 programs in our top 6 modernization priorities are we funding? Blank stares froze across the table. The briefer hemmed and hawed a bit, then started down the path of, "Well, sir, we've been working on this for almost a year. The budgets always start out pretty tight. As we looked at this, yada, yada, yada," my BS meter went off. I stopped him and said, "Just tell me the number." It was astounding to hear that it was such a small percentage of our overall budget. What happened was that the bureaucracy, Millie called it the machine, took over and did the same thing it had done the previous year, the year before that, and the year before that. Add a little here, trim a little there, and call it a day. There was no real prioritization. There was no bold shift. There was no appreciation that the Army's future was at stake, it seemed. In short, while McCarthy, Milley, McConville, and I were out beating the drum about transforming the Army, modernizing the BCTs, and preparing for a future fight with China, the bureaucracy had never jumped on board. Everyone was protecting his or her program and share of the pie. "You need to start over," I said to the group. "Go back, rank and stack every single one of our 500-plus modernization programs in priority order, and then come back in and tell me why each and every one is more important than our new modernization goals." I added, "Because as of today, the 31 modernization programs will be funded first, and we'll simply cut or reduce programs from the bottom of the 500-plus program list upward until we can afford the remaining programs at the top." The room went silent. People stiffened in their chairs. Folks glanced nervously at one another from the corners of their eyes. The tension in the large, dimly lit room went from 0 to 100. I also told them not to feel beholden to finding savings only in the accounts that needed more funding. In other words, if we need more dollars to put into acquisition, then we will go to the acquisition account first, but we would also go to the operations and maintenance, personnel, and other budget lines if need be. "Everything is going to be prioritized. Everything is going to be looked at. And everything is on the table. We have to be ruthless," I said. Milley, McCarthy, and McConville were all on board, and that made a big difference. The team scrambled off and came back in a few weeks. We started to review the first program on the list when someone from my congressional affairs team chirped up and said, "Sir, this program is important to Representative Blank," he said. "If you touch this, then we'll have a fight on our hands." "I get it," I said matter-of-factly, without reminding folks that I had worked on the Hill for several years. I expressed confidence that nearly every one of our programs has some type of congressional interest, sponsorship, or angle, I said. But if we let politics be a determining factor, we'll never cut or trim a program. We'll never free up money, and we'll never reform. And thus began what became known as Night Court. We began going through hundreds of programs, week after week, hour after hour. We canceled, cut, trimmed, delayed, and asked every question we could to get to ground truth. General after general, colonel after colonel, and occasionally a major stood up to brief. We grilled many hard. Some we praised,